A sign on the side proclaimed, "Welcome to Valhalla." On the side, a low deck offered several wooden tables, flanked by short benches. Land and Nez sat at the corner table, in plain view of the street. "There you are." Nez hadn't changed in the past few months. Still lean, like he was twisted together from steel wire. Same sharp eyes. His dark hair fell loose around his face. He wore a tailored charcoal suit. Good fabric, no padding on the shoulders, fitted through the waist, the English cut. About 3 grand, Hugh decided. The Legatus of the Golden Legion, the most powerful master of the dead Roland could find besides himself or his daughter. Nez nodded to him. Hugh nodded back. They'd been trying to kill each other for most of the last decade. The urge to borrow Stoyan's sword and ride Landon down was almost too much.
"Is he native?"
Sam asked quietly.
"Navajo," Stoyan said under his breath. "They kicked him out for piloting vampires."
Hugh altered course, aiming for Landon. Bucky obliged. "Join me?" Nez raised a cup of coffee. "Why not?" Hugh swung from his saddle, tossed the reins on the hook in the rail, walked up the 2 short steps, and landed on a bench opposite Nez. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Stoyan and the rest of his people turn and park themselves across the street at a breakfast taco hole in the wall.
"Coffee?"
Nez asked.
"Nah, trying to quit."
"What are you doing in my neck of the woods?"
"Have I told you you're lousy at sounding folksy?"
Folksy didn't come naturally to Nez, and he did it in a trained bear fashion, like a circus animal forced to perform against his will. If you decided to go that route, you had to mean it and sound genuine. Landon Nez had walked out of the Navajo Nation with nothing and climbed his way to a Harvard PhD and the top of the people's food chain. The man would stab himself in the eye rather than be confused with common rabble. Nez raised his eyebrows.
"It's just us."
You hit him with a broad grin.
"Just go ahead and be the snobby prick you are. Why are you here, Dambray?"
"Came to see a man about a horse."
Nez glanced at Bucky.
"Your horses do seem to be getting bigger and bigger."
"But wait, don't you think it's a bit on the nose?"
"Felt like it was time for a change.
How's life been treating you?"
Nez gave a one-shouldered shrug.
"Same as always. Research, management, undeath is a demanding mistress."
It would only take a second. Reach across, snap his neck, end all his earthly burdens.
"You wouldn't make it. Nez would never come here unprotected."
"What about you?" Landon asked. "Planning new campaigns?"
Here it was, probing for weaknesses.
"Settling down," Hugh said.
"You?"
"There is a time and place for everything."
Hugh leaned back.
"I've got a nice place picked out. Good supply, good defenses. Trees."
"Trees?"
Nez blinked. Hugh nodded.
"Eventually a man's got to put down roots. Looking forward to sitting on my porch, drinking a cold beer."
Nez stared at him a second too long.
"Got you."
The Legatus drank his coffee.
"Have you heard any odd news from the north?"
"Odd.
There is always odd news from the north."
A shadow of alarm flickered through Nez's eyes. The Legatus grimaced and nodded.
"That's the truth."
They stared at each other in silence.
"Do you miss him?"
Nez asked quietly. The void yawned in his face. Missed. The memories alone tore Hugh apart. The clarity of purpose, the warm glow of approval, the flow of magic between them. The certainty.
"There's more to life than being a dog on a leash."
Hugh rose.
"Got to leave you now. Places to be, people to kill."
"Always a pleasure, Preceptor."
Hugh grabbed the reins, hopped over the wooden rail, mounted his horse,
and started down the street. A few moments later, his people caught up with him. They rode in silence for another 10 minutes.
"How did it go?" Lamar asked.
"He'll attack us the first chance he gets," Hugh said. "He would have done it already, but something in the north has him worried. He's a careful asshole who likes to know every card his opponent is holding. I put a doubt in his head. Right now, he isn't sure if we have a permanent position or not, so he figures we can wait. We're easy to find, and we're not going anywhere. He would have to tell Felix to send some scouts north when they got back, to look for anything strange that would give Nez pause." The headache was returning, threatening to split his skull. A reminder of too many weeks spent drinking. Hugh gritted his teeth.
"Find me a base, Lamar. Someone somewhere needs something protected or something killed."
"It all depends on the price we'd be willing to pay," Lamar said.
"I don't care about the price. Do whatever you have to do. We secure a base, or the Legion slaughters us like pigs come winter." The mutter came from the center of the column.
"I'm fucking done running."
Hugh stopped and turned.
"Sentry, halt!"
Lamar roared. Beside Hugh, the long column of the Iron Dogs came to a stop, huffing and puffing, 80 soldiers arranged in two lines. When he'd arrived to Split Rock, where Felix had pulled together the remaining Iron Dogs, he found 333 people who used to be soldiers. They were ragged, tired, hungry, and their morale was shit. All military was tribal, his included. For the individual Iron Dog, the cohort was their tribe, the sentry within the cohort was their village, and the squad within the sentry was their family. In a fight, the Iron Dog stood as one. It went back to the basic primal cornerstone of human nature. He who attacks my family must die. There used to be good-natured competition between the squads, the sentries, and the cohorts, which Hugh encouraged, because it bound the soldiers closer together. But now, with the fragments of cohorts on his hands, he had to reform them into a new unit. Teach a man to fight, and you made him into a warrior. He didn't need warriors. He needed soldiers. To make a soldier, you had to put her with other prospective soldiers and make them go through hell and back together, relying on each other. They all had memories of walking through blood and fire with their old squadmates. He had to replace those memories with new ones, and so he did the only thing he could do to purge them. He'd sectioned off Felix's scout team and formed the rest of his force, 319 soldiers, into a single cohort, which he split into four sentries, 80 people for the first three, and 79 in the last. Stoyan, Lamar, Bale, and Felix each took a sentry. And then he ran them, tired and starving, into exhaustion. He smoked them until their arms could no longer hold their weight. He kept them from sleeping. He did it all with them, picking a different sentry every day. Respect had to be earned. The weather had conspired with him. It was hot as hell again. The tents Felix's people managed to acquire, he didn't ask for details, did the bare minimum to keep out the bugs. They were in their third week of training. Looking at the rage-filled eyes of the second sentry now, Hugh was reasonably sure that they hated his guts, which meant things were proceeding right on schedule.
"What was that, Barkowski?"
Lamar snapped, closing in on a tall, beefy dog with a freshly sheared head.
"I said I'm fucking done running."
Barkowski had about an inch of height on Lamar, and he made the most of it. But Lamar was harder, and they both knew it.
"What did you say to me?"
Lamar started.
"You're done," Hugh asked.
"Yeah."
Barkowski jutted his chin in the air. The man had been spoiling for a fight for the last 3 days.
"Then go."
Hugh turned his back.
"What?"
Barkowski asked, his voice faltering.
"Do you see a wall, dog?"
Lamar roared. The old habit got the best of Barkowski, and he snapped to attention.
"No, Centurion! Do you see guards posted? No, Centurion! Anytime you decide to leave, you can. Isn't that right, dog? Yes, Centurion! This isn't the seals. There's no bell to ring to announce you washing out, Hugh said. When it gets too hard and you want to give up, just quit. Get your gear and walk away. I need soldiers, not quitters. Forward!
Lamar drawled in the time-proven cadence of drill sergeants everywhere.
Double time! March!
Hugh started running again. The two lines of the second century moved with him. At least they were in step, he told himself. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Barkowski fall into his place and keep pace. In a perfect world, he would do this for another 3 weeks. He wasn't working with raw recruits, but seasoned soldiers. 6 weeks, 8 max, and he would have some semblance of a unified fighting force. He didn't have another 3 weeks. The game Felix's scouts brought, and what little they managed to purchase with the remainder of their money, were the only sources of food. He couldn't put his people through the crucible without feeding them. The dogs were burning through the food supply like wildfire through dry brush. Once the grain and potatoes ran out, they would have nothing except venison and rabbit. They needed more than that to keep going. The woods ended. They ran into the field, heading toward the tall wooden walls of the palisade in the middle of it. Above the simple fortification, the sunset was beginning, painting the sky with red and yellow. 3 minutes later, they ran through the gates.
Century! Halt!
Lamar snapped. The twin lines of the second century halted.
About face!
The sweaty, exhausted dogs turned to face Hugh. Lamar looked no worse for wear.
Tell your preceptor, thank you for the lovely stroll through the beautiful countryside. Thank you, preceptor!
The second century roared. A magic wave rolled over them. Hugh reached for the familiar power and concentrated.
Century dismissed!
The two lines broke as the dogs shuffled their way past him, toward their tents. A faint blue glow emanated from him, clamping each soldier in turn. He healed their blisters, cuts, and bruises in a split second. They moved past him, murmuring their thanks.
Thank you, Preceptor. Thank you, Preceptor.
Thank you, Preceptor.
The last dog headed to her tent. Hugh's stomach wailed. He healed them every day, and the rations he took were barely enough to keep him alive. Soon he would cross the line where his body ran out of reserves to compensate. Lamar halted before him, his gaze straight past Hugh.
What? Hugh asked. He's doing it again.
Hugh turned. In the small corral before his tent, Bucky glowed. A silver light shone from the stallion's flanks, as if each hair in his coat was sheathed in liquid moonlight. Hugh gritted his teeth. The next time he saw Ryan, he would kill him. Bucky pranced in the corral.
Everything but the horn,
Lamar said, his voice filled with pretended awe.
Do you have something to report, or did you come to jerk my chain? Good news or bad news?
Bad news, Hugh said.
We have food for 5 days.
In 5 days, they were done. The soldiers would need more than just meat. They burned too much energy for that. They required starches. Corn, grain, rice. There were none to be had. They were out of money, and unless they resorted to robbery, which would bring law enforcement on their heads, they were finished. Stoyan emerged from the first century's tent and pretended to loiter. Bale joined him. From the other side, Felix came up and decided to be very interested in Bucky, who was still glowing up a storm. They were up to something.
Good news? Hugh asked. I found a base.
Where?
Berry Hill, Kentucky, in the Knobs, right by Bluegrass.
Berry Hill. Sounded like something out of a child's cartoon. Hugh racked his brain, trying to remember what he knew about Kentucky. The eastern part of the state, the eastern coalfields, was mostly forested hills bisected by narrow valleys. It flowed into the Bluegrass region in the north and central part of the state, where gently rolling hills offered the perfect horse country. South of Bluegrass spread Pennyroyal, a massive limestone plain full of sinkholes and caves. On the edge of Bluegrass, stretched in a rough semicircle from Pennyroyal to the eastern coalfields, lay the Knobs, hundreds of steep, isolated hills, like cones set to mark the border. Post-shift, they were drowning in forests.
East or west side?
West, Lamar said. Closest city is Sandaville. Population about 10,000, give or take. Berry Hill is a nice settlement. About 4,000 people, mostly families with children. Excellent farmland, rich in supplies. The village is built by a lake.
Why did he have a feeling there was a but coming? Any militia?
Not enough to protect them. They are mostly nature magic types. Some witches, a few stray druids.
The feeling grew stronger. Why do they need protection?
Landanez is after their land. There is some sort of magically saturated spot on it, Roland wants. Landon can't go after them directly, because he's been warned by the feds that land grabbing won't be tolerated. So he recruited some asshole politician from Sandaville to harass them into selling their land to the town. Sandaville is escalating the pressure, and they don't want an all-out conflict.
Bucky trotted over. Hugh reached out and patted the stallion's cheek.
Why not?
Because their leader does the kind of magic that panics good old regular folk,
Lamar said.
They are trying to put down roots. They don't want people coming for them with pitchforks and torches. They're desperate.
And they think adding 300 trained soldiers to their settlement will be enough of a deterrent.
In a nutshell.
It sounded perfect. The settlement already had an issue with Nez. They had no militia to speak of, which meant there would be very little conflict. They had supplies that would keep his people fed. Stoyan and Bale had drifted close enough to hear the conversation and were eyeing him.
What's the catch? Hugh asked.
They don't trust us, Lamar said. We walked away from Patterson and Willis, both when they needed us most. They expect us to betray them.
We followed orders, Hugh said.
It was still a betrayal.
He puzzled over it. Roland had wanted them out of those conflicts, so he took his people out. He tried to remember if he had argued against it. He wanted to think he did, but his recall was cloudy. The precise memory of the event slipped through his fingers, as if he were trying to pick up water in his fist. He pulled his troops out, and their former allies died. An echo of guilt rose from the depths of his memories, and he pushed it away.
Did I even argue against it?
Yes, he did. There was a phone call when Roland told him to abandon Willis. Hugh was sure of it. Things had been much simpler then. He didn't have to wonder if it was right. Roland wanted it, therefore it was right. He longed for that simplicity, and at the same time, a hot, angry thought surfaced in his brain. He went back on his word. His word wasn't worth shit. He should have been able to say, I'll do it, and that should have been enough assurance to guarantee an alliance.
Their track record isn't much better, Lamar said. They had an agreement with a town in West Virginia, and ended up bailing on them 3 years ago. Before that, they bounced from town to town, either leaving because they didn't like it, or getting run off by the locals. The information is conflicting.
Why do they keep running?
There are some nasty rumors about the kind of magic they practice.
Lamar hesitated.
Spit it out.
The story is, our peaceful nature magic users had some disagreements with a few covens in Louisiana. The covens decided to wipe them out and banded together during the flare. Not the last one or the one before that. 2 flares back.
A flare was a magic wave on steroids. It came once every 7 years. During a flare, magic rained for several days. Weird shit crawled out of their hiding places. Gods walked the earth, and impossible things became possible. During that flare, Roland had destroyed Omaha.
The Louisiana Covens called themselves the Arcane Covenant. When the flare came, they summoned something, a horde of dire wolves or demons, nobody quite knows. Lamar continued. They should have wiped our nature guys off the face of the planet, but here they are alive and thriving, while the Arcane Covenant is dead as a doorknob. Rumor says human sacrifice was involved.
Terrific.
Of all the fucked up magic, human sacrifice was the one threshold even Roland wouldn't cross. It opened the door to old primal powers nobody wanted to resurrect.
Nobody has proof that any of it happened, Lamar said. But it makes any alliance appear shaky. We're both desperate, and Nez will expect us to cut and run the moment things get hairy.
You leaned on the corral's fence. That was a problem. The only way to hold off Nez was to project a show of strength. The alliance had to appear unbreakable, otherwise Nez would expect them to fracture and attack anyway. Lamar was right. They had to overcome that burden. They had to appear completely united.
There is a tried and true method of making an alliance appear secure, Lamar said carefully.
Hugh glanced at him.
A union, Lamar said,
as if worried the word would cut his mouth.
What union?
A civil union, Preceptor.
What the hell are you on about?
Lamar took a deep breath.
Marriage!
Bale yelled out. Hugh stared at Lamar.
Marriage?
Yes.
They had to be out of their minds.
Who would be getting married?
You.
The realization hit him like a ton of bricks, and he said the first thing that popped into his head.
Who would marry me?
You're handsome. A big, imposing figure of a man. And,
Lamar scrounged for some words.
And they're desperate.
What the hell have you been smoking? I'm penniless, I'm exiled, I own nothing.
He left out broken.
And a recovering alcoholic.
Lamar nodded.
Yes, but again, they are desperate, and we are running out of food.
Hugh shut his eyes for a long moment. The world was sliding sideways, and he really needed to get a grip.
Who would I be marrying?
The White Warlock.
Hugh's eyes snapped open.
You want me to marry a man?
No.
Lamar shook his head vigorously.
It's a woman. A woman, not a man.
Thank God for small favors. He couldn't keep the sarcasm out of his voice.
Well, I'm relieved it hasn't quite come to that.
It's a business arrangement before anything else,
Lamar said quickly.
But if you're married, that will cement the alliance. You said yourself. You told Nez you are ready to settle down. He will believe the marriage.
They have a castle,
Stoyan said.
Apparently, some rich guy bought an old castle in England before the shift, had it disassembled and brought to Kentucky.
You like castles,
Bale said.
It's a good, defensible position,
Felix said.
At least meet the woman,
Lamar said.
Shut up,
Hugh said. They fell silent.
Did you come up with this idiotic idea?
Hugh demanded.
It was a joint effort between me and my equivalent on the other side,
Lamar said.
If it helps, your prospective bride has to be talked into the marriage as well.
Perfect. Just perfect.
He reviewed his options. He had none. He could marry some woman and feed his troops, or he could let them get slaughtered. What the hell? He'd done worse in his life.
I'll see her, he said.
That's all we ask,
Lamar said.
Chapter 3.
The wind died. The tree line was still, the wide leaves of sycamores and the frilly foliage of oaks hanging motionless in the fading heat of the early evening. Nothing moved. Ilara leaned on the heavy grey stones of the parapet and sent her magic forward. A sick feeling flowed back to her, a greasy, nasty smear on the soothing face of the forest,
like an oil spill on the surface of a crystal clear lake.
There you are.
Rook reached for his small notebook, wrote a message, and passed it to her. Do you see it?
Yes, it's alone.
The blonde spy nodded, an impassive look on his tanned, scarred face. Logic said he must have felt emotions, but if so, they were buried so deep that no hint ever rose to the surface.
Thank you,
Alara said. The notebook disappeared into some hidden pocket of his soft leather jacket. He crossed the rampart to the inner edge of the battlements, hopped onto the parapet with the easy grace of an acrobat, jumped down, and vanished out of sight. The vampire remained where it was, in the shadow of a sycamore, invisible from the wall. But now she knew it was there, there would be no escape. An undead here, only a few dozen yards from the castle and the settlement on the other side. A creature piloted by a master of the dead, capable of carving its way through their settlement. Next to her, Dugar stirred, brushing a persistent insect away from his grey hair. The older man was very tall and lean to the point of being almost wiry. A scar crossed his face, carving its way through his forehead, his dead milky left eye, and across his cheek, until it disappeared into his short beard. Both his beard and hair had gone white long ago, but his eyebrows kept a few black hairs, stubbornly refusing to age. He was wearing his white robe today. It suited him much better than his usual get-up of Bermuda shorts and a t-shirt. The druid stroked his beard.
They're getting bolder by the day.
It would seem that way.
An undead so close to the castle meant a long-range navigator, likely one of Nez's Golden Legion Masters of the Dead.
I'll get the hunters, Dugar offered.
No, I'll take care of it.
They're due to arrive any minute.
All the more reason to handle it myself.
She smiled at him.
I'm faster than the hunters. We wouldn't want the undead to frighten our delicate guests.
The druid smiled into his beard.
I have a feeling this guest won't scare easily.
I hope you're right. Don't worry, I'll be back in time.
She released her magic. It struck out like an invisible whip and splashed against the trunk of a white oak. She inhaled, took a single step toward that anchor, and let the air out. The world moved. She stood in the forest now. The wall of the castle lay 50 yards behind her. Massive trees spread their branches above her head. Magic waves destroyed technology, but they nourished the wilderness. The forest around her looked half a millennium old. A few yards to the left, and she would come across the remains of ruined houses, completely buried in the greenery. The vampire ran. She still didn't see it, but she felt it scuttle through the underbrush, sprinting away.
Oh, no you don't.
Alara hurried after it, anchoring and moving, each of her steps swallowing 15 yards. She could have moved faster, but expending magic came at a price. She would have to replace it. Thinking about it turned her stomach. Thinking about their guests turned her stomach also. She should have let the hunters handle the vampire, but tension simmered in her, too close to the surface. She had to let some steam out of the pressure cooker, or she wouldn't be able to sit through the meeting. The undead ran for its life, bouncing off the tree trunks. The hunger inside her woke. Alara chased it, losing herself to the speed. The vampire vaulted over a huge fallen tree, and she finally caught a flash of its back, once human skin, now a thick, pallid hide.
Prey.
A head, bright red ribbons tied to the tree trunks announced the end of their land. She'd run 4 miles. The undead bolted for the safety of the ribbons, aiming for the gap between two trees. She released her magic in a cold rush, stepped in front of the vampire, and caught the abomination by its shoulders. Her power clutched it. The hunger clawed at her from the inside. She bared her teeth. The undead's red eyes sparked with a new, brighter fire. The navigator controlling the vampire had bailed. The sudden death of an undead could turn the navigator into a human vegetable. Those who reached the rank of master knew when to let go. The undead flailed, but it was too late. Ilara found the small, hot spark of magic within it and swallowed it.
She could almost imagine tasting it on her tongue, as if it were a delicious morsel, and for a long moment she savored it. The vampire went limp. Ilara opened her arms, and the sack of dried flesh and bone that once used to be a human body, then an undead, and now was neither, collapsed to the forest floor.
Too little.
The hunger howled inside her.
More, more.
She chained it again with a brutal effort of will and forced it back into the dark place she kept it.
Horses.
Ilara turned. She was only a few feet away from the narrow ribbon of the road that ran through the woods. Run or sneak a peek? Was there even a choice? She stepped back a dozen yards, behind a wide old oak, climbed the low-hanging branches, and settled above the ground, melting into the shadows among the foliage, as if she were one with them. Riders approached. The leading man was tall and dark-haired. That matched Dugar's description. Her magic splayed out, masking her.
Do not see me.
The man halted his big white horse and turned toward her. She couldn't see his face from this distance. She couldn't feel his magic either, but he had some, she was sure of it.
Do not see me.
Ilara couldn't see his eyes, but all her senses told her he was staring straight at her. An excited shiver ran down her spine. She was a complete and utter idiot, she decided, sitting here, hiding like a child, afraid to get caught.
Well, at least it's good to be self-aware.
He gave the forest another long look and rode on. Ilara slipped from the tree and dashed back to the castle. A few minutes later, she stepped past the gates, straightened her long green dress, and checked her hair. Something skittered under her fingers. Ilara plucked it from the long braid coiled at her neck. A spider. She walked out the gates and gently set it on the grass. The spider escaped. She wished she could too. Anxiety flooded her. It's just nerves, she told herself. Ilara walked up the steps to the wall and touched the druid's shoulder. He turned, his brown eyes somber.
I told you I would make it.
He shook his head.
I know you don't want to do this. I don't, but I'll do it for my people.
Her people. She knew every single one of them. She was the reason they bounced back and forth across the country, desperately trying to find a place to call home, only to be run off again and again. They deserved a home. This was their land, and she had to do everything in her power to protect it. Perhaps Dambray wouldn't prove too much of a problem.
We could. Pick up and leave again?
No. She shook her head.
You said it yourself. We've been here too long. This is home now. I'm not going to uproot us again. Not for this.
They were done running. She wouldn't let Nez win. A group of riders broke free of the canopy and rode up the road toward the gates at a canter. She clenched her hands together. This was ridiculous. She had nothing to be nervous about. She could pull the plug at any time. The riders grew closer. Ilara nodded at the leader on the white horse.
Is that him?
Yes. Hugh Dambray was huge. The stallion underneath him was massive, but the man matched the horse. He had to be well over 6 feet tall, wide shoulders, long limbs, very lean, almost as if he should have been 30 pounds or so heavier. Dugard did say they were starving. Starved or not, he looked like he could hold the drawbridge of a castle by himself. It was suddenly very real.
I don't want to do this. You want me to marry Conan the Barbarian?
The drop of acid slid into her tone.
An attractive barbarian,
Dugar pointed out.
I suppose so, if you're looking at it from a purely animalistic point of view.
Dugar chuckled.
Is his horse glowing?
She squinted at the stallion. If you looked just right, there was a hint of something protruding from its forehead, like a shimmer of hot air.
It appears so.
They made a striking image, she admitted. The horse that was glowing with silver, and the rider, all in black, his dark hair falling to his shoulders. but she wasn't interested in striking images. He's been here 2 minutes, and already he's riding like he owns everything he sees. He very likely always rides that way. Men like him project confidence. It's what makes others follow them in a battle. Violent others. We agreed that we needed skilled, violent soldiers with broad backs, Dugar said. His back is broad enough.
The breadth of Dambray's back wasn't the problem. She spared a few moments for his people. Two men rode directly behind him, one tall and black, with glasses perching on his nose, and the other athletic and white, with short brown hair and an attractive, smart face. The rider behind them was just a boy, blonde and tan. Why bring a boy? Wolves coming to her door. The riders reached the gates. Dambray raised his head and looked up. His eyes were a deep, dark blue, and they stared through her. She held his stare. Most women would find him handsome. He had a strong face, overwhelmingly masculine without a hint of the brutish thickness she'd expected. His jaw was square and strong, the lines of his face defined but not sharp or fragile, and his eyes under a sweep of thick black eyebrows were too shrewd and too cold for comfort. His eyes evaluated her with icy calculation. She was about to share the power over her people with this man. Alarm squirmed through her. This was a bad idea, a terrible idea. Dambray passed through the gate and out of her view.
I shouldn't do this, Alara whispered to herself. Do you want me to send them off?
Dugar asked quietly. If she said yes, he would.
She had to get a grip. She had to teach Dambray who she was. The white warlock. Unclean, cursed, an abomination. They would come to this meeting table as equals, and if they chose an alliance, she had to make sure they left as equals.
The magic escaped the world without so much as a whisper, stealing her power. That was fine. She didn't need magic to make Hugh Dambray understand where they stood.
Let's wait to throw him out until he balks at our terms. Do you want them in the Great Hall?
The druid asked.
No. She narrowed her eyes. Put them in the green room, next to the kitchens.
The air smelled like fresh bread, just out of the oven, with a crisp golden crust. Hugh's mouth watered, while his stomach begged.
Clever girl.
He once starved a woman to the brink of death, trying to break her. Poetic justice, he reflected.
The castle is in good shape, Stoyan said softly behind him.
The castle was in excellent shape. It was built with pale, grayish-brown stone. The 40-foot-high curtain wall and the massive barbican, the gatehouse protecting the entrance, were both solid, as were the two bastion towers at the corners and the two flanking towers. The bailey, the open space inside the walls, was clean and well-maintained. He didn't see a well, but they must have one. The inner structure consisted of a constellation of buildings hugging the main keep, a 100-foot-tall square tower. He caught a glimpse of the stables and the motor pool, attached to the east wall. The electric lamp suggested they had a working generator. The place was massive. It needed a moat, something he would have to remedy. A large Melosa dog trotted in through the open door, wagging its shaggy white tail. He'd seen three so far as they rode up and walked through the bailey, each dog over 120 pounds. They reminded him of Kurakachan hounds he'd come across in the Balkans. The dog wandered over to him and Hugh patted its shaggy head. Kurakachans were wolf killers. If Lamar was right about the size of their livestock herds, the dogs made sense. The castle and the town attached to the shore of the lake were wrapped in dense forest. There would be wolves there. The inside of the castle was as well taken care of as the outside. The room where he now sat at a big rustic table was simple, the stone walls without any decoration, but it was clean, his chair was comfortable, and the temperature inside was at least 10 degrees cooler. Nice thick walls. All Hugh had to do now was convince the owner of the castle to let him share it. He'd gotten a glimpse of her as he rode in. Her hair was completely white. Not pale blonde or bleached platinum. White.
Her hazel eyes were sharp, and she looked at him like she saw a wolf at her door. He wasn't a wolf. He was something much worse, but he needed her defendable castle and her delicious bread. Hewitt tried to pin down her age, but the white hair threw him off. Her face looked young, but he'd barely seen anything beyond a glimpse. Hugh leaned back. She was making him wait. That was fine. He could be patient. Behind him, someone's stomach growled. He'd felt something in the forest on the way here. Something that raised the hair on the back of his neck. He'd tangled with powers across three continents, and whatever had been in the woods had tripped all of his alarms. Then it had moved toward the castle, and he'd nudged Bucky into a canter, trying to follow it. His gaze stopped on a large hand-painted map above the side door, showing Berry Hill in the center, by the edge of the Silver River Lake, with the castle on the neighboring hill. On the right and slightly above, to the northeast, lay Aberdeen, another small post-shift settlement, next to a laypoint. Higher still, past the woods, directly north, spread Sanderville. Above it in the distance, on the far left, was Lexington. Hugh looked at Aberdeen. Post-shift, magic streamed through the world in currents, ley lines, offering a fast way of travel and shipping. Walking into the current would get your legs cut off, so you had to put some barrier between the magic and yourself. A car, a wooden pallet, anything would do. Once in, the ley line would drag its rider off until it reached a ley point, where the magic blinked, interrupted, and the current would jettison its riders out into the real world. There was only one road connecting the castle and that ley point, and it ran through Aberdeen. They would have to play nice with that settlement. The heavy wooden door opened, and she walked in, followed by a one-eyed older man in a white robe, a black woman in her late 40s in a pantsuit, and a petite blonde. Hugh tilted his head and took in his future bride. Somewhere between 25 and 30. A loose green dress fell almost to the floor, hiding most of her. Nice full breasts, long legs, pretty features, big eyes, small mouth, eyebrows darker than her hair. Pale brown, probably drawn in or dyed. Tan skin, almost golden. Interesting face. Not exactly beautiful, but feminine and pretty. A cold expression stamped her face. A hint of arrogance, some pride, and a lot of confidence. There was something regal about her. Queen of the castle. She would be a massive pain in the ass. Just get through it. Hugh rose to his feet. She held out her hand. Ilara Harper. Her voice matched her, cold and precise. He grasped her fingers in his and shook her hand. Hugh Dambray. Nice to meet you. She sat in the chair opposite him. Her advisors arranged themselves behind her. You already know Dugar, she said. He didn't, but Lamar told him the druid was his counterpart. A voice of reason. Someone had sliced up the older man's face. Hugh met his gaze. Dugar held his stare and smiled. A tough nut to crack. This is Savannah LeBlanc. The black woman nodded to him. Expensive clothes, professional, well put together. Her dark natural hair pulled back from her face and twisted into an elegant bun. She looked like a lawyer. Hugh met her gaze. A witch, a powerful one. He couldn't feel her magic with tech up, but he'd interacted with enough of them to recognize the bearing. Bad news. She is the head witch of our covens, Ilara continued. Covens, plural. Interesting. This is Joanna Carey. The blonde smiled at him. She had to be in her 20s, but to him she looked too young, almost a teenager. Barely 5 feet tall, slender, glasses. Petite small blondes were Stoyan's kryptonite. Her hand flew up to her forehead, thumb pressed against her palm in a kind of salute. Hello. She was deaf or mute, possibly both. His knowledge of American Sign Language was rusty. ASL had its own rules and grammar, but he remembered the basics. He raised his hands and signed, Lovely day. Joanna's eyebrows rose.
Interesting.
Interesting was the right word. He would have to work on his gestures. You introduced his people. Stoyan, centurion of the 1st century. Lamar, centurion of the 2nd century. And Sam, he's here to assess the horses.
Savannah moved to the side, so Joanna could keep them both in her view, and signed as he spoke. Her hands moved fast. She clearly didn't need any practice. Another blonde woman in jeans and a t-shirt slipped into the room through the side door. She was young and pretty, and she looked at him a moment too long.
Can I get you anything? Iced tea, please, Caitlin,
Elara said.
Yes, ma'am.
The woman ducked into the doorway.
You need an army, Hugh said. We need a base.
She nodded.
You have an army and I have a base.
So far they were in agreement.
Shall we talk terms? She asked. What do you need from us?
My people will need barracks, rations, and equipment, he said.
That's reasonable, she said.
They aren't farmers. They won't be tending the fields or milking your cows. They won't assist your people in daily tasks unless it's an emergency.
She raised her eyebrows.
So what will they be doing all day?
They will patrol the grounds. They will drill, perform PT, repair and fortify the castle, and take care of any external threats we will face.
He slipped that we in there. The sooner she saw them as allies, the sooner he would get his people fed.
PT?
She asked.
Physical training. You are hiring us as employees with specific jobs. We must be free to do those jobs.
I'm picturing 300 people lying about, eating my food, and drinking my beer all day,
Elara said.
Only when they are off duty. They will patrol the castle and the outer perimeter in shifts, and if they do choose to drink beer in their off hours, they will pay for it.
Which brings me to another point. They will need to be paid. Elara leaned back.
You expect me to feed them, clothe them, equip them, and pay them?
Yes. I expect them to put themselves between you and danger.
If we paid each of your people $500 per month, the bill would come to $150,000 per month. If we had that kind of money, I would hire mercenaries. I wouldn't have to stoop to this farce of a marriage.
Stoop? Oh, really?
When Ness slaughters your people like cattle, and you walk among their corpses, inhaling their blood, you should tell them that.
Elara drew back.
I've taken care of my people until now. I'll take care of Nez without you.
I can take this castle with 20 people, Hugh said. I can burn it to the ground, or I can kill all of you and take it.
She leaned forward, her eyes fixed on him, icy with rage.
Try it.
He leaned toward her.
I can do this because my people are professional soldiers. You will treat them like soldiers.
We don't need you.
Yes, you do. I saw Nez a month ago. He's coming.
The blonde Caitlin appeared in the doorway. Savannah took the pitcher from her hands, waved her off, and set the tea on the table. Ilara's eyes narrowed.
And I should take your word for it?
Yes.
The word of a man who betrays his friends.
The word of a man who is willing to marry you with all of your baggage. I don't see a line of suitors outside this door, do you?
She recoiled.
How do I know you're not working for Nez?
He is the preceptor of the Iron Dogs,
Stoyan snarled behind him. Hugh raised his hand. Stoyan snapped his mouth shut.
Nez wouldn't bother with subterfuge, Hugh said. You're not worth the trouble. You're easy pickings.
She opened her mouth.
How many of your people can kill a vampire one-on-one?
She didn't answer.
Each one of mine can. They've been trained to kill them, because Nez and I spent a decade trying to murder each other. He sent me the head of my childhood friend, and then he and I had coffee in Charlotte a week later. That's the kind of man Nez is. So snarl all you want, princess. But you will marry me because you have no choice.
You won't win this fight with farmers. You need a cold, ruthless bastard like me, and I'm the only one here.
They stared at each other in silence.
It has to be food, equipment, and board for now, she said. Take it or leave it.
I'll take it. In return, you'll let me make modifications and repairs to this place as I see fit. You will finance it, if needed.
We will discuss each modification individually, she said.
No.
I may not have the money.
Fine. We will discuss the budget for each modification, with the understanding that my requests for materials and labor are to be given first priority.
Fine, she ground out. We do not tolerate crimes here. While your people are here, they will obey the laws. If one of them murders or rapes one of my people, you will kill that soldier. If you don't, I will. And believe me, they will wish you had done it.
She'd caved on the upgrades. You had to give her something.
Agreed. I will need 15 horses.
They were 17 mounts short, and horses were damn expensive.
Done.
Shit, should have asked for 20.
And just to be crystal clear, Ilara said, this marriage is in name only.
Sweetheart, you couldn't pay me enough.
Pink touched her tan cheeks.
If you betray us, I'll make you suffer.
We haven't even married yet, and I'm suffering already.
We have that in common, she snapped.
They both leaned back at the same time. He was marrying an ice harpy. Fantastic. Just fantastic. Dugar stepped forward, leaned and spoke into Ilara's ear.
I'll need to inspect your troops,
Ilara said, her voice precise.
We need to know exactly what we are buying with our food.
Fine. He gave her a lazy smile. My men will need to inspect your horses and our quarters in the castle.
Make your troops available to us first.
Hugh poured himself a glass of tea and nodded at the doorway.
Look outside your walls.
She would strangle that man. No, she would do worse. Ilara strode outside of the gate onto the top of the hill where the castle sat. Soldiers filed out of the forest, running three to a row. They wore black uniforms, some in armor, some without. Each carried a large backpack, a bedroll, and weapons. They moved in unison, their feet striking the ground at the same time. She hadn't detected them in the forest, which meant they had to have been far behind. The soldiers began to form a block, eight soldiers in a line. All of that equipment had to weigh at least 20 pounds, probably a lot more.
How long have they been running?
She asked and wished she hadn't. Any show of interest was an opening, and Dambray would wedge his big dumb shoulder through it and hold it open. Dambray shrugged, looming next to her, a darkness shaped like a huge man.
From Aberdeen.
10 miles.
Yes. He turned to her, his dark blue eyes calm. Would you like them to run back and here again?
He was completely serious, she realized.
No.
He turned to face the soldiers. They formed four separate blocks, each 8 soldiers wide, 10 lines deep, and froze, like dark statues against the green grass of the lawn.
Do you want them to rest? She asked.
Are you tired?
Dambray roared next to her, his voice carrying across the field. She almost jumped. The 320 people roared back in a single voice.
No, Preceptor!
They're ready for your inspection, Hugh said.
Ilara had to admit, they looked impressive. Guilt pinched at her. This wasn't about Dambray's people, she reminded herself. This was about keeping her people safe. If Dambray put his troops in jeopardy, it was on him. The creaking of a wagon came from behind them. Slowly, carefully, George, Saladin, and Cornwall came into view, leading Dakota, a massive Clydesdale, as he pulled the wagon forward. A brown tarp hid the contents. She knew exactly what was in the cart. Ilara stepped aside to let the wagon pass. Dambray didn't appear concerned. The three men guided the wagon down the hill, slowly, as if it were made of glass. Dugar walked behind them, silent. Each of the men carried a shotgun. The wagon came to a stop. Saladin unhitched Dakota, and the three men walked away, back toward the castle. Ilara raised her head.
You said each of your people could take a vampire.
Dugar pulled the tarp off the wagon. An undead sat in a metal cage. The moment the tarp came off, it lunged at the metal bars, its eyes glowing with insane bloodlust.
Prove it,
Ilara said. Dambray nodded at his soldiers.
Pick.
Ilara stared at the rows of soldiers. She was about to sentence one of them to death. A human, even a skilled human, had very little chance against an undead. She had to do her job. He would put his strongest people in front and in the rear, so she had to pick from the middle.
Fourth row on my left, she said. Third soldier.
Arend Garcia,
Dambray ordered, his voice rolling.
Step forward.
The third man in the fourth row took a step back, turned, and marched to the edge of the line. Turned, marched toward them, turned again. Dead man walking. He was in his late 20s, dark hair cut short, light eyes. Like all of them, he was lean, almost underfed. A scar crossed his face on the right side of his nose, slanting to the side and barely missing his mouth. He was about to die. If she showed any care at all, Dambray would use it to get out of this test. Arend Garcia came to a stop. She checked Dambray's face. It might as well have been cut from a rock.
Kill the undead,
Dambray ordered, his voice calm. Garcia dropped his bedroll and backpack, stepped forward, facing the cage, reached behind his back, and pulled a brutal-looking knife free. It looked like a slimmer version of a machete, its blade black. Dugar picked up the chain attached to a heavy metal bar, securing the trapdoor release on the cage, and backed away. Garcia watched, impassive. The undead hammered itself against the bars.
Damn it. You're going to let your man face an undead with a knife?
Dambray glanced at her.
Did you want him to kill it with his bare hands?
No.
She barely knew the man, and she already hated him.
At least give him a sword.
He doesn't need a sword.
Dugar yanked the chain. The bolt slid free. The undead tore out of the cage, lightning fast, and charged Garcia. At the last moment, the slender man stepped aside, graceful like a matador, and brought the machete down. The blade cleaved through the undead's neck. Its head rolled onto the grass. The body ran another 10 feet and toppled forward, the stump of the neck digging into the grass. Ilara realized she was holding her breath and let it out. Garcia pulled a cloth from the pocket of his leathers, wiped the blade, slid it back into its sheath, and stood at parade rest.
Are you satisfied?
Dambray asked.
Yes.
The word tasted bitter in her mouth. She should have been happy. She wanted crack troops, and she got them. Ilara forced a calm expression over her face like a mask.
Thank you, Preceptor.
He smiled. He was clearly enjoying every second of this.
Anything for my betrothed.
She almost punched him. Dambray nodded to Garcia. The man pulled a small knife out of the sheath on his belt. A woman broke ranks and ran up to him. Together they knelt by the fallen undead.
What are they doing?
Harvesting the blood. It stays viable for quite a while when properly stored. I'll see those barracks now.
This way.
Ilara turned and led him inside the castle.
About this marriage, he said.
I meant what I said.
Good. Because I like the blonde that brought us tea.
The nerve.
My people aren't slaves, Preceptor. If Caitlin wants to let you climb on top of her, that's her business.
Excellent.
Am I going to get a bedroom, or should we come up with a rotation schedule? He was baiting her. He had to be. You're getting your own bedroom, Preceptor. Splendid.